Well, I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Simon Brodbeck, who teaches in the Theology and Religious Studies Department at the University of Cardiff. Simon's done work on the epics, and he did a book with the Routledge Hindu Studies series, actually, on narrative and gender in the Mahabharata. I can't remember the precise title. And he's been working on the idea of embedding. So he's looked at the Mahabharata, the epic, and looked at the process whereby different sections are embedded in other sections, and this sort of embedding process is very interesting, in a way parallel, I think, to the Greek material as well. But he's not only done that, he's also looked at this material through the lens of contemporary concerns about gender and identity, social location, and so on. So today he's going to talk to us, give us a paper on with the title "Towards an Existential Textology of the So-Called Sanskrit Epics." I look forward very much to hear what you have to say about it, Simon.
Thanks, Gavin. Thanks. Well, I'm very happy to be here. So there's a handout to go with the talk. So if you pass those down. Well, anyone that's had a look at my abstract will have thought this is far too much for any one talk to contain. So, the title describes, I suppose, my overall project in recent and coming years. So, for this version, when I sat down and wrote the paper, it came out with a subtitle, which is Apratishto Bhavet, Refuge and Reform. The talk is mostly about the Mahabharata, and I've used the text in a kind of post-colonial mode, and explores some of the themes in my recent book, which I've brought along to show you, of which I'm very proud, The Mahabharata Patriline. But that's, I guess, only peripherally important right now. Papers in 15 sections. They're marked out on the handout along with some of the quotes that I'll use. So I'll direct you to look at specific bits where relevant. I've written this all up, so I'm just going to read it, if that's all right, but I will look up from time to time. Mm-hmm. So, section one, introduction.
Shall I bring water, glass of water for you?
That would be kind, yes, thank you.
Please start.
The Ramayana tells of the war on distant soil between Rama Dasharatha of Ayodhya and Ravana's demon hordes, in which Rama was the victor. The Mahabharata tells that story too, amongst others, and it orders business chronologically, such that the righteous war that Rama won is followed some distance northwest of Ayodhya as the generations pass by the massacre of the inhabitants of Khandava forest by Arjuna and Krishna, the massacre of practically all Kshatriyas by the Pandavas and their allies as advised by Krishna at Kurukshetra, and as the generations continue to pass, by Janamejaya's massacre of snakes at Takshashila, a purge which was suspended on condition that the surviving snakes behave themselves. And in the meantime, Krishna and the Vrishnis have all killed each other at Prabhasa. Thank you. And the Harivamsa, which concludes the Mahabharata, fills in some details of what Krishna did before and after the business at Kurukshetra, including his licking various miscreants into shape. In this paper, I'm going to take those various massacres as a depiction of one ongoing process and begin to explore some of its ramifications. The process is an iterative royal rite of expansive self-assertion involving the appropriation of land and the exploitation of the resources thereby obtained. Section 2. Janamejaya calls off the snake massacre. Why didn't Janamejaya's snake massacre kill all snakes? Well, it was intended to, but Janamejaya changed his mind about it halfway through, while listening to Vaishampayana's story about the Pandavas, and he called it off uncompleted. Perhaps this was because long ago, long before Janamejaya, the snake massacre was set up by the mother of all snakes, Kadru, who cursed her children to die in it, and by Brahma, who specified that only the wicked snakes would die in it, and that the dharmic snakes would be spared. Now, one might think it rather unlikely that after the massacre started, only wicked snakes were killed, and then there was a ceasefire precisely at the point where there were no more wicked snakes to kill, so that by stopping precisely there, Janamejaya left only dharmic snakes left alive. By the law of averages, it may seem that some dharmic snakes were probably killed before the massacre was called off. But in terms of adharmic snakes left alive after it, it is notable that Astika makes the surviving snakes solemnly promise at the end of the massacre that they will never attack anyone who knows the story of how he saved them. So in the wake of the massacre, and in connection with certain public statements, there is expected to be a reform in the behaviour of the snakes. Section 3. Ashoka calls off the Kalinga massacre. We can compare Janamejaya's ceasefire with the famous 13th major rock edict of King Ashoka. This edict specifically concerns Ashoka's recent massacre of the Kalingans. After the ceasefire, the good King Ashoka, the handsome one, beloved of the gods, advertises across his realm that although the enormous death toll has saddened him deeply, he will resume the killing with full fury upon any and all who misbehave. The conditionally aborted genocide seems to be a common theme in ancient Indian textual artifacts, and more examples could easily be cited. This theme in the Mahabharata has been written on by Minkowski, Fitzgerald, and several other scholars. Section 4, the post-colonial Mahabharata. Ever since I read The Autochthonous Element in the Mahabharata by D.D. Kosambi, it has been one of my favourite papers. Kosambi takes the slaughtered snakes, and the ones left alive, to be human beings. He sees the context as one in which plough agriculture was gradually taking up more and more land, and practitioners of older types of economy were increasingly being made into refugees. The Mahabharata certainly showcases changes in land usage. In it, good kshatriyas are often depicted stripping the land of its wild beasts, and its human inhabitants too must either perish or be tamed. The burning of the Khandava forest by Arjuna Pandava and Krishna Vasudeva is mythologized as an offering for Agni, but it is quite obvious what is going on. The young Pandavas have been given the outlying region of Khandava Prastha by their uncle Dhritarashtra, and they must make it work for them. So they clear woodland by fire, kill whatever flees the fire, and then move in. Elsewhere, on several occasions, we hear how Bhima Pandava, a man like an elephant, pulls up trees for fun. And there is economic growth. The next thing we know, the Pandavas have had a great city built, and they are famous on the high-class circuit, hosting grand parties, no expenses spared. The Mahabharata depicts this scenario in very plain terms. The large-scale clearing operation at Khandava Forest is replicated on a smaller scale by any number of royal hunting expeditions, whereby dangerous beasts are killed in outlying regions, and the spoils of the chase are distributed with a view to domesticating the locals and developing the land. Rama's activities in the Aranyakanda of the Ramayana can be seen in an allied fashion. Rama goes to the wilds and kills demons, taking out the nasty big men and winning the respect of those who remain. These texts thus exemplify and explain the various ideological moves through which the victims of development are effectively dehumanized, and through which the expansionist activity of their overlords is presented as a birthright or a case of manifest destiny. If the activity and ideology thus depicted were to be described as colonial, then the Mahabharata could be a post-colonial text, and perhaps we should read it as such. In fact, as fate would have it, the next thing that happened to the murderous bastard Pandavas was that they lost their lovely capital and were kicked out and had to live homeless themselves for many years. But they came back again in the end and killed even more people and managed to take over properly. And that was many years ago. But what about the refugees? Section 5. Padmanabha the snake. His name means lotus navel. In the last episode in the Mahabharata's Moksha Dharma Parvan, Bhishma tells a story that Narada once told Indra in heaven. A good householder Brahmin is spiritually anxious and bewildered by the plurality of apparent soteriological options. And he voices his concern to another Brahmin who is his guest. The guest says that he feels the same. But to try to help his host, he says that he once heard about a good snake called Padmanabha, who lives in Naimisha by the river Gomati. He recommends his host to go and find that snake and to ask him for advice. In the morning, when the guest leaves, the householder says goodbye to his people and goes off too, and travels to Naimisha in search of Padmanabha. After another Brahmin gives him directions, he finds Padmanabha's house. Well, Padmanabha is away pulling the sun's chariot, and his wife tells the visitor he won't be back for 15 days. So the Brahmin waits, fasting, in adjacent woodland by the river. In time, Padmanabha returns and is received by his lovely and dutiful wife, who tells him how good she's been while he was away and why, and then tells him there's a Brahmin waiting for him. Padmanabha is surprised. He says human beings are not normally able to see snakes. But the wife tells him to go and see this fellow anyway. Padmanabha says, and this speech is on the handout, "Due to the vice of arrogance that resulted from the station of my birth, my pride was plentiful, but my willful anger has been burned by the fire of your words, good woman. And I don't see any dullness worse than anger, good woman. Snakes got a bad reputation through their characteristic anger. The brilliant ten-necked, i.e. Ravana, was overpowered by this vice and so competed with Shakra, and he was killed in battle by Rama. Hearing that a youngster had been abducted from the inner chambers by Rama, that is Rama Jamadagnya, the sons of Kartavirya were moved to anger, and because of their offensive, they were killed. Powerful Kartavirya, who was like the thousand-eyed Indra, was struck down in battle by Rama Jamadagnya on account of his anger. Having heard you talk, I have checked anger, this enemy of austerity and ruin of good fortune. And I extol myself in particular for having you as my all-virtuous wife, O constant and long-eyed lady. I will go to where this twice-born is staying, and when he's spoken, he won't leave with his purpose unfulfilled. He'll get everything he asks for. So Padmanabha finds the Brahmin, and the two introduce themselves. But before asking the question that he has come all this way to ask, the Brahmin asks what Padmanabha has seen while he was away. Padmanabha extols the sun and says that he has seen a blazing figure approach, be received by, and merge into the sun, and that the figure was a person purified through performing the Uncha vow. The Brahmin now says that thanks to Padmanabha's words, even before asking him the question that he has come all this way to ask, he has had it answered. He knows that he must undertake the Uncha vow. And he takes his leave from Padmanabha forthwith and goes off to see Chyavana Bhargava, who initiates him into the Uncha vow. And that's the end of the story. And it is known because Chyavana later told it to Janaka, who told it to Narada, who told it to Indra, who told it again in his own assembly, where the Vasus heard it, and they told it to Bhishma, and then he told it to Yudhishthira. And that's according to Vaishampayana, who told it to Janamejiya, while Ugrashravas was listening, and Ugrashravas told Shanaka. And that's according to the narrator of the Mahabharata, who told me, and now I've told you. This story, because it is told to Janamejaya's great-granduncle, Yudhishthira, must, in theory, take place before Janamejaya's snake sacrifice. But Padmanabha's comments about snakes seem to match the situation after the snake massacre has been aborted. And there's no reason why they shouldn't, because despite the fictional setting, the story is told by Ugrashravas after the snake sacrifice. Padmanabha says that because he was born a snake, he has a natural tendency to anger. He decries anger and illustrates through stories of others how getting angry leads to one's downfall. He says that the natural anger of snakes has led to them being despised as a class, and he says he himself has prospered because he has become magnanimous and restrained his anger, thanks to his dutiful wife. Now, the dutiful wife here is very interesting and, I would say, crucial, and we will return to her. But first, what is this Uncha vow? So, section 6, the Uncha vow. The Uncha practitioner who merged into the sun is described by the sun as follows. And this quotation also is on the handout. This fellow gathered roots and fruits and ate fallen leaves too. He was a steadfast seer, drinking water and eating wind. And verses from within the collections were recited by this seer, by means of which he has gone to the third heaven. His efforts built him a door to heaven. This seer, who was cheerful, resolute, and without expectations, and whose food was always gleaned or scrumped, was harnessed to the welfare of all creatures, O snake. The key here is the livelihood of gleaning, which goes hand in hand with humility, landlessness, and a lack of material ambition. It is the lifestyle of the rishis. And in several stories, we meet particularly generous gleaners, such as Mudgala. Section 7, the story of Mudgala. In the Mahabharata's Aranyaka Parvan, while they are living in the woods, Vyasa tells the Pandavas the story of Mudgala. Mudgala lived in Kurukshetra with his wife and sons, and he lived like a pigeon, gleaning grains of rice. But nonetheless, he was able to feed the gods and all his guests. He was open with his hospitality, gladly feeding even the Brahmin Durvasas, who started turning up once a month, naked, shorn-headed, abusive, and very greedy indeed, and emptying Mudgala's cupboards every time. After 6 months of this, seeing that Mudgala showed no consternation whatsoever, and was always willing just to go out gleaning again, Durvasas declared that Mudgala was so perfected that he would go to heaven in his own body. And the envoy of the gods appeared immediately and invited Mudgala to step aboard the celestial chariot. The envoy describes all the heavens and says that the heaven awaiting Mudgala is an extremely lofty one indeed. But Mudgala refuses to mount the chariot, saying that the heavens are all impermanent and he doesn't want to go to any of them. Nonetheless, the encounter has a profound effect upon him. He gives up gleaning and instead just pursues intensive meditation. And when he dies, he is extinguished completely in nirvana. Perhaps Mudgala is a refugee intellectual, and the offer of heaven is the offer of a good job in the new regime, and Mudgala refuses it. It certainly seems that even gleaning his refugee economy is being made as hard as possible for him, and he is faced with a choice of getting progressively poorer or, as he sees it, selling out. He chooses the first option. But perhaps amongst gleaners he is a special case. Perhaps some gleaners might not be visited by Durvasas, and perhaps some of those who are, and who pass his test, might accept the envoy's offer. Section 8. The story told by the mongoose. After the Kurukshetra war, Yudhishthira, like Ashoka, feels acutely the sorrow of the recent slaughter over which he has presided. Also, he is in a very precarious position, since his nominal victory has been achieved by enormously unpopular means. Duryodhana, before dying, instructed Sanjaya the herald to tell the truth about the Pandavas, and all our narrators agree that they were cheating bastards. And there is a fine to pay for their war crimes. This price is paid in many ways, one of which is that Yudhishthira has to perform an inordinately munificent Ashvamedha, at the end of which, when the costly gifts are distributed, Yudhishthira is roundly and publicly abused by a mongoose. The mongoose ridicules Yudhishthira's bloody rite and says his grandiose gifts do not match the humble ones once made by a certain gleaner who used to live in Kurukshetra, a practitioner of the Uncha vow, and his family. This poor but generous householder was visited one day, in a time of famine, by a particularly greedy Brahmin. He nobly surrendered all of his own miserable portion of barley meal to his guest, and one by one, after him, each member of his family surrendered all of their food too. His loving wife, his good son, and his dutiful daughter-in-law. The visiting Brahmin was revealed then to be Dharma in person, and he declared himself satisfied with his hosts to a very high degree, and he produced a celestial chariot, and the family got in it and went off to heaven. Here we see the virtues and possible rewards of making do uncomplainingly with grinding poverty. In this story, in place of Durvasas, there is Dharma, and one senses that by riding the chariot, this family haven't really sold out, as Mudgala refused to do, but have rather perhaps just starved to death. Doing the Uncha vow, living like a pigeon, could be what Padmanabha was away from home doing when his Brahmin came to visit. There, the Brahmin visitor was hungry only for knowledge and was not economically hosted by the family. He stayed fasting in the adjacent woodlands. But in any case, if Padmanabha is a gleaner, he is the only one who is explicitly said to be a snake, and he would therefore be a reformed, non-biting snake, making do with his lot, his anger subdued. Section 9. Satya, Ekalavya, and the Nishadas. Gleaners are vegetarian. The son's description of the Uncha vow mentions fruits and roots, and several other descriptions mention grain, and liken the practice to that of the pigeon. The vegetarianism of gleaners is underlined by the story of Satya, which is told at Mahabharata 12, chapter 264. Satya lives in the forest with his wife and lives by gleaning. A deer comes and announces that it wants to be eaten. And when Satya hesitates,
just a test.
They were testing in the theology faculty on Wednesday.
Thursday.
Is it a test?
Officially, it means we have to leave the building. Now you can. I'll leave it to you to decide what to do. We can close the door, and I'm going to go downstairs. And I reckon within a few minutes we'll have turned it off. So, just to let you know.
Marvelous.
So I take it all back.
Well, we think we can probably get out the window.
Good luck with that. We've never been able to get it open.
Oh, is it stuck?
You can break it.
Anyway, sorry.
The intermission wasn't long enough for ice creams.
No, not long enough for ice creams.
The vegetarianism of gleaners is underlined by the story of Satya. Satya lives in the forest with his wife and lives by gleaning. A deer comes and announces that it wants to be eaten. And when Satya hesitates, it describes the glorious heaven that awaits Satya if he eats it. Satya eventually gives in and agrees to eat the deer. But then it reveals itself to be Dharma in disguise, and it scolds Satya for his lapse. and sets him back on his previous diet, with his vegetarianism reinforced. If wilderness is being taken over by agriculture, then where there once were fruits and roots to gather in season, there might now only be stubble fields and left behind grains. Or perhaps there would be cleared pasture land with the possibility of getting a bit of milk. The ascetic Sharmika subsists by living off the milk that leaks from the mouths of suckling calves. And in the Mahabharata, there is considerable respect for this lifestyle. And let's not forget that the great Kshatriya kings of yore were famous for giving away cows to good, honest Brahmins. Or at least they were famous for being told to do so. Rakshasas, and sometimes asuras, are demonic, flesh-eating creatures. The Kshatriyas, who have a monopoly on human violence, tame them. Kshatriyas also tame and receive tribute from lesser Kshatriyas. And they also tame Nishadas, as Arjuna and Drona tamed Ekalavya. Nishadas are small, dark, and dirty. They wear deer skins, they live in the wilds, and they live by hunting or fishing. Some of them are said to be cannibals. Their lives are certainly expendable. They originate from an eponymous ancestor, Nishada, who was churned from the right thigh of bad King Vena's corpse, and was immediately told by the rishis to stay down, Nishida. Nishada's younger brother was the paradigmatic good King Prithu, who was churned from the right hand of Vena's corpse. The friction between Nishada status and royal business is clear. A young Nishada, Ekalavya, the son of Hiranyadhanus, that is Golden Bow, comes to try to join Drona's school, at which the Pandavas and Kauravas and any number of other young braves are learning their martial arts. Drona rejects Ekalavya on account of his being a Nishada. So Ekalavya goes back into the woods, and using a Drona dummy as his teacher, he practices archery by himself. He gets incredibly good, and Arjuna finds out about it and tells Drona, and Drona comes and demands a tuition fee from Ekalavya, and Ekalavya promises to pay it. And Drona demands Ekalavya's thumb, and Ekalavya severs it and gives it. And so Ekalavya is nullified, and Arjuna can be the best archer in the world. Ekalavya's agreement to pay Drona's fee is like the promise made by the surviving snakes, to be harmless. And it is like Padmanabha's renunciation of anger. Diplomatic tactics are used against Ekalavya, and he unilaterally decommissions his weapons. Presumably, Satya the gleaner would have become a Nishada had he started eating deer. And presumably Ekalavya, now that he can't hunt, will have to become a gleaner. Section 10. Karpavya and the Dasyus. Karpavya was the son of a Kshatriya man from a Nishada woman. He lived the Nishada life in the forest. He was an expert bow hunter and gleaner. And he dutifully fed and honoured his parents as they aged, and he fed the Brahmins and their visitors. He was elected by the Dasyus, that is, by the rogues or barbarians, to be their chief. And he made the Dasyus agree to a certain code of behaviour, which is on the handout. Karpovya said, "You ought not slay a woman, nor one who is cowering, nor a child, nor an ascetic. A non-combatant man should not be slain, and women should not be taken by force. Under no circumstances should the female of any kind of being be slain by a warrior. Everything must be good for cows and Brahmins. One should make war for their sake. But grain should not be trampled down, nor should anyone erect any obstacles to the ploughing of the fields, nor where the gods are paid honour, or the ancestors or guests. Of all beings, a Brahmin deserves to be let go free. And any recompense that is to be made to them should be made, even if it is the whole of one's property. In all the three worlds there is no one who will save the man whose ruin they intone when they are furiously enraged. He who insults Brahmins or approves their extinction will be ruined as surely as the sun will rise. He who lives here looks to the benefits of doing so. Our army will attack any who do not remit to us as they are able. The rod of punishment has been ordained for the purpose of education, not for the sake of inflicting corporal punishment. That is the settled conclusion. Corporal punishment is taught by tradition to be lawful for use against those who harm educated people. There are some who make their living by damaging the country. For that reason, they are likened to worms upon a corpse. On the other hand, those barbarians, that is, Dasyus, who would live in this world in accordance with the learned traditions of law, attain perfection directly, even though they are barbarians." That's from Fitzgerald's translation. A lot of this, I would say, is redolent of Ashoka's Kalinga Edict. At the very least, there is an explicit threat of violence upon those who misbehave. Section 11. Arjuna curses Ashvasena. When Arjuna and Krishna are feeding the Khandava forest to Agni, one of the creatures that they terrorize and then kill is the wife of Takshaka the snake. Takshaka is away in Kurukshetra at the time, but his snake wife is there in Khandava forest with their young son Ashvasena. The pair are trapped, and the mother responds by trying to swallow the son. At that moment, Arjuna shoots her head off with an arrow, and then Indra intervenes to distract Arjuna, and Ashvasena manages to escape. Arjuna curses Ashvasena as he escapes, and then he starts fighting Indra, who let him escape. Arjuna's curse. This is on the handout. English translation. Wrathfully, the terrifier cursed the snake, and so did the fire and Vasudeva. Quote, "Thou shalt never find shelter." That's Apratisto Bhavet. Translation by Van Buitenen. Minkowski and others have discussed how this scene sets up an ongoing family feud. Years later, during the Kurukshetra War, Ashvasena attempts to get his own back on Arjuna, but he fails and is killed. And then, years after that, Arjuna's grandson, Parikshit, is involved in a diplomatic incident and gets assassinated by snake bite. By the bite of Ashvasena's father, Takshaka. And it is to avenge his father Parikshit that King Janamejaya begins his massacre of the snakes. Section 12. Valmiki curses the Nishada. The curse that that Arjuna casts upon Ashvasena bears considerable comparison with the famous curse that Valmiki casts at the beginning of the Ramayana. The curse, which turned out to be the first verse in the Shloka meter of which these texts are predominantly composed. The story goes like this. Valmiki chances upon seeing a pair of cranes mating. And then, a passing Nishada kills the male in the act. And the female weeps, and Valmiki is moved and curses the Nishada. Here's the curse, it's on the handout. May you find no peace. This is Julia Leslie's translation. May you find no peace, Nishada, for all eternity, because you killed the male of this loving croucher pair when he was intoxicated by desire. This Ramayana curse, Ma Pratistham Tvam Agamaha, is variously translated. Goldman has, you shall not live for very long. Shastri has, mayest thou seek in vain for a resting place. The curse of Ashvasena is effectively the same. A pratisto bhavet. Thou shalt never find shelter. In both cases, the victim is deprived of his pratistha, his foundation. And this would fit the general analogy between snakes and nishadas. These are landless people. Section 13. Lineal tensions in sexual reproduction. My interpretation now takes perhaps a slightly unexpected tack by focusing on the violent acts immediately preceding these two curses. In both cases, an arrow is fired and it kills. In the Mahabharata, Arjuna's arrow kills the snake mother as she is trying to encompass her son. In the Ramayana, the Nishada's arrow kills the male of a mating pair of cranes. I understand these arrows in terms of lineal paradigms. I was born into a realm without a king, and it is still without a king. But consider the royal lineal paradigm as we see it in Sanskrit texts. Ideally, in every generation, there's a king, son of the last king, and his brothers make up the army. This ideal is explored thoroughly in the Mahabharata and Ramayana, and it is not just for kings. The ideal is patrilineal and patrilocal. It works by young women being given away in marriage by their natal family to their husband's family. They then move house and they have sons under their husband's family name. This is explicitly the kind of family that the gleaner has in the story told by the mongoose. His family consists of him and his wife and their son and his wife. Any daughters, having been given away, would be living elsewhere with their husbands' families. And the families of Padmanabha, Mudgala, and Satya would by implication be the same kind of patrilineal family, where wives and mothers are always relative newcomers from another family, and where marital relations are in terms of the husband's need for a son. At the other extreme, another lineal paradigm can be imagined, whereby women are not given away in marriage, but stay with their first family, and men come from elsewhere to inseminate them and then go off again. These two paradigms are mixed up in practice. After all, we have two parents and we have brothers and sisters. But in one paradigm, the sons would grow up with their father's people, and in the other, they would grow up with their mother's. It's one or the other. The compromise position would be to switch back and forth between the two, and or to live in a third place, where neither parent belongs. That's what my parents did. Now, if we look at the two arrow scenes emblematically, we see in one case a mother being killed and failing to keep her son. And in the other, a father being killed, but a mother left alive, albeit very sorrowful. The two lineal paradigms are in play here. Or perhaps we should say that one is at play with the other, for in these texts we see it always with the royal family's centre stage. It seems that the royal model, wishing for sons in each generation, would be rather inconvenienced were its daughters-in-law to take their sons home to their own fathers. That's what Yayati's wife Devayani did. One day, she got up, took her sons, and went back to her dad. So, in our arrow scenes, Arjuna, the hero, kills the mother. And Valmiki, the author, curses the one who kills the father. The maternal lineal paradigm is not developed in these texts. It exists as a shadow, a neurosis, an abomination. It is shown only in the process of being rubbed out. It is the feared snake bite that can kill a patriline. With a snake cursed in one case and a nishada in the other, we can see how the class system is glossed with the gender system. Section 14, the good wife. Padmanabha makes it explicit that the taming of his dangerous snake heritage is a result of his excellent wife. She has helped him conquer his wild instincts. Now, we could envisage the wife as Padmanabha's moral tutor. But perhaps what has specifically enabled Padmanabha not to bite anybody is the fact that his wife is a good patrilineal wife, a wife who was given away by her father and who is now devoted to Padmanabha and his lineal interests, and will give him a good son so that he will have no need for any daughters she might produce and will be able to give them away. I think that the basis of the famous model of the Pativrata, the devoted wife, is lineal, and that the devoted wife stands in the same symbolic position as the reformed snakes. The good king's harem is thus a product of his civilizing mission. As Padmanabha makes clear, even if an intruder comes and steals a youngster from one's inner chambers, one must not take offense, for if one does, one is likely to pay with one's life, as Kartavirya's sons did. Section 15, Krishna and Bana. At the end of the Mahabharata, the Harivamsha features several incidents in which Krishna does battle with his own in-laws, or with those of his son, or with those of his grandson. The fight with Bana is particularly striking in the present context. Krishna's grandson, Aniruddha, and Bana's daughter, Ushas, fall in love. And Aniruddha goes to live with Bana's people. So, Krishna and various family members go there, defeat Bana and his warriors in battle, and bring the couple back to live with Krishna's family. Here, Krishna is an enforcer of the patrilocal model. Krishna's people, the Vrishnis, are interesting. They were refugees from King Jarasandha of Magadha's royal civilizing mission on the Yamuna. Krishna led them to flee, and they made a home in Dvaraka out west by the sea. This must have been at around the same time as Krishna and Arjuna burned and depopulated the Khandava forest. Perhaps a little while before, perhaps a little while after. In any case, Krishna throws all his diplomatic weight behind the Pandavas' patrilineal efforts and makes sure that they win the Kurukshetra war. The Vrishnis are presented as Yadavas, that is, descendants of Yadu, one of the sons of Yayati, that Devayani took with her back to her father. Later, Krishna presides over the massacre of the Vrishnis and Dvaraka is flooded. The last we hear of Krishna's line is that his descendant Vajra is brought back from Dvaraka and finds a home in Indraprastha, where the Khandava forest used to be. We can imagine that Krishna's descendants through this line would be thoroughly reformed after Janamejaya's snake sacrifice, even if not before. And that's the end of the paper.
Thank you. Well, we've got half an hour for discussion and points.
Sorry, it's quite horrific.
It's very gritty, some of these stories, aren't they? They're very sort of... it makes you wonder, as you've been pointing out, the degree to which these stories are signs, if you like, of a social reality going on and so on that you've been talking about. It's very interesting. I was wondering about snakes. I mean, who these snakes are, really. Do you ever get the term Nagas? Do you ever get much reference to Nagas?
Yep.
It's a kind of supernatural.
Well, that's the word used for Padmanabha.
Yes.
He's said to be a Naga. But I think that often the...
human beings can't see snakes or something. There was some.
That's what Padmanabha said, yes.
Yeah. So I was thinking of Nagas, you know.
Whether that means they're magic or not, I don't know. I rather take it as meaning that they are disguised, that you can't tell who's a Naga and who's not. Like real snakes, there might be loads of them around, but they hide. You know, they keep out of the way.
Mm.
So.
There are many levels at which they're invisible. That real snakes do hide and you can't see them.
Yep.
Also, that if they're in some way transcendent, then that's another level. But you could also use that idea of not being able to really see a snake as a metaphor for what's going on in human beings.
Mm.
Well, we do talk. I think even in English, we do see people as having snake-like qualities. Maybe completely inappropriate that there was any sense of that in any other culture. But that might be another be another level at which you think about snake or snake-like qualities.
Mm.
Yeah.
Is that completely off?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we do refer to them. You old snake in the grass, you.
So, I mean, what do you think, in Indian
context, what this snake symbolize. I mean, in Western tradition, there is this snake as a tempter. But then I thought in Indian tradition, the snake is also like a, you know, Vishnu is lying on the snake. And so that snake also has kind of positive image as well. But in general, the kind of snakes which appear in your talk was kind of negative, right?
Well, potentially negative, certainly powerful, and certainly in need of being made to behave. Potentially a force of chaos. Unless, but once they promise to behave, if they do behave, then no harm done.
Yeah. But then you're kind of suggesting that maybe these snakes are symbol of the force or the people which are to be controlled. So I'm just curious at why the choice is snake. Why not like a boar or I don't know, wild boar or something? Why snake in this particular Indian context? I'm just trying to understand sort of cultural connotation that the snake has or may have.
Well, I think it's because they're very dangerous. I mean, I don't really know what it's like to live somewhere where there's lots of poisonous snakes, but I'd imagine that in such places, everybody knows families who've lost children that have stepped on snakes, or just kind of got too close and been bitten. And I think it's a real fear, and so for me, that's the thing about these refugees, as I'm trying to make them out as refugees. If they decide to fight back, then they can be extremely dangerous. And one way which they might fight back almost accidentally is perhaps through a tradition of not giving away their daughters in marriage, so that if there is intermarriage between a snake and a non-snake, the snake family, if their son, the non-snake family, if their son has married a snake, might discover that they can't get any sons, because the woman will present the sons to her father, and they won't be available. And I think actually that's what happened with King Parikshit, that he had an affair with a snake woman, and the son made himself unavailable to his father's family.
Arjuna also married with the Naga princess. I mean, Arjuna, I forgot exactly when, but then he at one point went down and discovered and married. I mean, I thought, and I don't remember what happened afterwards.
They had a son, and the son died in the Kurukshetra battlefield.
Ah, okay.
I forgot which one was it.
Hiravan.
Hiravan.
Yes, he turns out to be loyal to his father.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But because he married the celestial, you know, snake woman, you know, not the poisonous, you know, or dangerous one, you know. I think it's a divine.
Well, she dragged him down underwater.
She was dangerous too. I mean, the celestial can be dangerous.
I think she was dangerous, and but that she fell in love with Arjuna, and so she fell in love with him more than he fell in love with her. So he had the power to get the son.
So, what do you think? I'm sorry. At the time when the epic was composed, what do you think the snakes were? In the social history that they represent, if they represent. Do you have any opinions on that? Speculations?
Well, Kasambi thinks that they represent hunters and gatherers who were gradually losing the lands over which, off which they lived. And Kasambi suggests that these peoples were quite varied groups of tribes who held the snakes in particular reverence and had a kind of snake totem. I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly agree with the first bit, but I'm not sure about the snake totem. I mean, I suspect that there's enough similarities between the danger that these people represent and their ability to kind of hide. Enough similarity between them and snakes to kind of explain the use of the term. But the other thing is that Kosambi would certainly take this Mahabharata as talking about a real historical situation, whereas, although I think probably there was quite a bit of that going on at various times in ancient India, I would see it primarily as a fiction. Absolutely. I mean, most fiction writers do an awful lot of research to make sure that they have verisimilitude in their fiction, so that it's set in real context.
Or the other way around, that it starts off as a reflection of real social, society and issues, and then, gets into story, legend. I mean, that's the whole history legend myth. One way of using the word myth, history legend myth, is an indication that that can happen. So it's difficult, and it's difficult for. Well, maybe not be difficult for you, I don't know, but it would certainly be difficult for me to try and demonstrate which way that's gone.
Sure, sure.
Because we've lost so much.
But certainly, I mean, you could imagine a genre of fantasy where the actual universe in which the story is set is made up.
Mm-hmm.
But with fiction, it's kind of normally set in the real world. Mm-hmm. You know, it's we believe that it could actually happen. And I think most of the Mahabharata is like that. There are kind of fantastical touches. But they can be read as figures of speech. I mean, we all exaggerate, don't we?
I mean, you're reading history out of the text, then, in a sense. You're not reading it into it. You're reading history out of the...
Well, I don't know, not really. I mean, I'm just saying what's in the story, really. I mean, we do know that this kind of thing goes on all the time.
Mm.
Don't we? Economic expansion, felling of trees, big hoo-ha about...
Yes.
Exactly. I mean,
it's all very relevant.
It's all stuff that is... If it is a true story, it's not a true story about ancient India. It's a true story about many times and places. In that respect. So.
Including the fear of other people's cultural practices, whether it's who gives away their daughters or takes them back to their father or whatever it is. It's an illustration of that sort of fear.
They were taking out the principles of social order and the dynamics. Yeah.
Something that you and Peggy were talking about sort of reminded me of the Jain sort of retellings of the Ramayana, where they take the story of the Ramayana and they sort of make some adjustments to it, and one of the things they do is they say, well, okay, we have Rama there, and he enlists this army of these vanaras, of these monkeys, but they say, well, this you cannot take this sort of, they cannot be monkeys, because monkeys, they don't fight with humans. So they have this whole theory that the monkeys, the vanaras, were actually not monkeys, but were men that had sort of a monkey as their symbol on their flag or something like that. So something like Kosambi would say. And therefore, sort of they were just sort of some tribes that lived in the forest, but human people that sort of were enlisted. Anyway, that was just sort of something that came up.
That's a Jain theory, is it?
Yeah, the Jains.
It's very rational, isn't it?
Yeah. But then on the other hand, they have the thing that when they go to Lanka, then they have, of course, they have the bridge with the stones and so on, and that they find also too incredible. So then they say, well, they got into a Vimana and flew over and went on the other side and then got off. And
which is less incredible.
And another thing that I kind of was reminded of in the very end, where you have the Valmiki cursing the Nishada, And that verse, of course, is sort of that curse is said to be sort of the origin of the whole Ramayana, and therefore sort of in poetics it's sort of been an object of discussion as well. But I seem to remember, and I'm not 100% sure who it is, but I think it's Abhinavagupta in his commentary on the Dvanyaloka, where he takes it that that the Nishada does not actually kill the male bird, but kills the female bird. And he has a whole sort of, I forget the exact details of his argument, but it's sort of, he argues that it's the female bird that was killed and not the male bird. And then, if I remember correctly, it's something to do with Rama being separated from Sita, and sort of Rama is lamenting because Sita is not there and so on. And that's sort of being reflected in this story of the curse and so on.
Well, it certainly links to the story of Rama and Sita, because in Valmiki's ashrama, Sita is there, having been rejected by Rama, presumably lamenting over the loss of her husband. So it, I'm taking it out of context in a way in the interpretation that I've given it. But wouldn't this Abhinavagupta's interpretation be? I mean, surely it says in the Ramayana, I don't know the verses specifically, but doesn't it make it explicit that it is the male?
Yeah, but I forget the details. He has something to say on it.
Right.
But I forget exactly what his point, or sort of where he's going with it, or why he's arguing for that. But I'm fairly sure it is Abhinavagupta, but not 100% sure. I mean, the thing, of course, comes up in the Dvanyaloka. Anandavardhana, you know, talks about this there, and Abhinavagupta then comments on that. I think it's there that this thing comes up. I think what's his name, Masson, he wrote an article on that.
In terms of the Vanaras, I mean, there are words, lots of words used to describe these monkeys. Some of them make it explicit that they would be monkeys, though again we can interpret that if we like. But it's interesting that the most common word, Vanara, doesn't mean monkey.
Yeah.
It just means creature of the woods.
Yeah.
So that could very easily and literally describe a forest tribe.
I thought it was an all man of Vanara. Is it a man or what sort of thing? An all man. Is it a man or what?
Isn't that Kinnara?
That's Kinnara, yeah.
Oh, Kinnara. Kinnara, yeah.
But I mean, in the description of Hanuman, surely there's that episode that he put the fire on his tail and then kind of went around. And I suppose, I mean, if he was the one of representative of these Vanaras, then doesn't seem like Hanuman was a human, does it?
Yeah, but that the Jains kind of reject that whole idea.
Oh, right.
They retell the story.
So then.
But they say the reason they're seen as monkeys is because sort of their totem is a monkey, not because they were actually monkeys.
But just so then they have to also reject this Hanuman's tail.
Yeah.
Could be holding a
totem.
Well, we know how possible it is when talking about despised peoples to reduce them to subhuman status, call them animals, and then it's only a small distance from there to kind of flesh out the picture with the, you know, making out that they really are animals.
Mm. I mean, in some ways that the category of human being is very modern, isn't it? I mean, historically speaking, who we regard as human being now wasn't regarded as human being, right?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean,
barbarians are still human, aren't they? Barbarians are still human, aren't they? Even
well,
though they're rather lessened.
The Dasyus are, yeah.
It's culture that makes them lesser, not.
but it's very, I mean, God's very clear in Genesis that there's a big difference between humans and other animals.
Mm.
If anything, I'd say it's gone the other way, and that nowadays we are realizing that there is not that much difference. I mean, I was just looking at the Times today, and there's a beautiful picture of a, it's at some chimpanzee sanctuary, and an old chimpanzee has died, and it's being buried. And all the other chimpanzees are there, watching in mournful and respectful poses, in utter silence, like human beings.
Well,
and I was looking at a television program where they were investigating this group of elephants that they thought might have died from a lightning strike, or were they poisoned? But at the point where they'd done the autopsies on the corpses and then built cremation pyres and burnt these were just a small group of elephants from a whole group. The rest of them had gone off to the forest, but the adults here were very heavily pregnant, so they lagged behind and they got struck by lightning. And they did, in the end, they did demonstrate that's what had happened. But at the point where they lit the fires and the funeral pyres, the carcasses were burning, all the rest of the elephants came back out of the forest and stood around.
Mm.
It's just amazing when they filmed that, you know, to see that. They had this sense of what was happening and came to pay their respects, along with all the villagers, you know. And it's quite incredible. I mean, I know elephants are incredible, as are other animals.
Yeah.
It's just a very moving piece, all silently just walked out of the forest and stood around the human parts. And normally animals would be afraid of fire.
Mm.
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 Mm. One classic, I mean, the term jati can refer to different kinds of animals as well as different segments of human society, or plants, domestic animals, wild animals, and all different jatis.
I just felt you mentioned that now we come to understand that there's not much difference between the human and the animal. I thought that in a previous history, perhaps before the Industrial Revolution, you know, that there was more interaction between the, you know, the animal world and the human world, you know, without, and especially in Indian context, without, you know, sort of using the animals simply for, you know, without possessing their own life. Just being there, you know, for the humans, but they have their own, you know, purpose and, you know, intelligence and intuition.
Well, I suppose in this day and age, with so many of us living in cities,
yeah,
we don't actually have many interactions with live animals, do we?
Yeah.
A lot of us. I mean, when I lived in the city, the only creatures I ever saw were the foxes.
Mm.
And they keep it out of the way.
Mm.
And the pigeons.
And the pigeons, yeah. And the pigeons. Oh, yeah, squirrels. Yeah.
And this question and this discussion actually reminded me of an issue which is probably, you know, more conversant with all this subject. But how much such reading of Mahabharata is really reading into, in a sense, putting the values and understandings of our own into the text, you know, where is this thin line when you are actually interpreting it like this?
Well, it's a tricky question, isn't it? Because obviously that would be a terrible thing to do.
Yeah, and you might get.
And yet, what on earth else is one supposed to do?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's inevitable. I suspect that some of the things that we have been told to respect in the text and not remove and not erase by putting in our own understandings are actually not necessarily there. Like with these gleaners, I mean, traditionally, nobody's written much on the gleaners, but traditionally, the idea has been that this is a highly meritorious religious practice. I think it just looks like people living on whatever they can get because they can't get anything else. I'm beginning to think more and more that a lot of traditional religious interpretations of these texts are, well, obscure aspects of the texts and shouldn't be allowed to crowd out other interpretations. So I suppose what I'm saying is I'd be sceptical of anybody who would claim to know what's really there. Anybody that says, don't put your own interpretation of the text, respect it for what it is. Well, what is it? You know, nobody.
Yeah,
I don't think I'm any worse in any worse a position than anybody else in the world to have a go.
This is a very important, isn't it, question about the interpretation of all sacred texts. The whole question. There are two things: whether we're able to recover a sort of sits in Laban, a context out of which they have come, but then also this interrogating them in every age with what are the sort of questions and interests we have for a time, which are going to change. But in a category of texts here, of things remembered, it's precisely its greatness and its relevance that it's possible to do that.
Mm.
From age to age, ask the sorts of questions that we're interested in, and we, from age to age, and they'll change and flow back and forth, and rather than to think that there is something there that's just come down and it's kind of absolute as well. I mean, this is just much more powerful for us in terms of not only historical human interest, but even in terms of religious practice and inspiration, I think, isn't it? But as a sort of the type of very important question that people, have a challenge by in relationship to all their sacred texts, which of course are all of different kinds, people want to say, but this is a things remembered, and therefore it's got a kind of historical vehicle containing it. It is what people have remembered, and therefore it's going to be what seems relevant to them at a particular time. And then we're saying, well, if it is relevant to us, then the questions of our time, as well as saying, the questions from which it arose. So, but that is a question for our time too, isn't it? We want to know about historical context. In another 50 years, people will be layering with another lot of questions while still respecting what you've uncovered here. And the amazing knowledge of the details of the text, which I thought relatively few people have, certainly I don't have, but it's just very interesting. It makes it more relevant for us on every level, spiritually, in terms of literature, in terms of history, as human beings, than other ways of looking at a sacred text, I think. That's what I would feel. Because right from being an undergraduate, I've felt this kind of challenging and questioning, because in terms of how people reacted to historical critical works on biblical texts. But I just, from what I've just said, I feel that very strongly, that it's actually much more powerful when we're doing this and having real human context and able to make it glow in our own, in response to our own interrogation.
Well, as far as historical context is concerned, it's very difficult to tell. I mean, most of what's supposedly known about ancient India is extrapolated from texts. So if you then try and understand the text in terms of that historical context, it's totally circular. So I mean, in general, the historical context is just gone. To me, it's world literature. And if it's going to work as such over 2,000 years, then like any great literature, it must be because it's about things that are true of human beings in human societies across 2,000 years at least.
Which don't change.
Right, and kings going around and stealing land for economic growth is absolutely still going on.
Just translate kings.
Yes. Well, I wonder if republics do it less. Perhaps they do.
I mean, the text itself would claim to be historiography, wouldn't it, I guess? Well, not the text, people... the received tradition of the text would claim that the text was historiography. Your reading of the text is somewhat sceptical of that, but you're nevertheless saying there's a hidden historiography within it.
It could be.
That you're culling out, as it were.
Mm.
One of the issues, it seems to me, this is a bone of contention, is that with some exceptions, like your Jains, India never made the distinction between muthos and logos. It never made that separation, which the West did, which allowed historiography to develop. And India never developed historiography because it didn't make that move.
So how then can the traditional, i.e. Indian, view of the text be as historiography?
Would that be only
in the wake of us teaching them what such a thing might be?
I would say Ricoeur wants to pull history together with fiction, but you have to have some... I can see why, of course, both have the structure of narrative.
Mm.
But you have to... it's very difficult, isn't it? I think you have to have some criteria of... of the notion of an event. You have to have some notion of an event that constrains your narrative.
Constrains it.
Constrains it. And I suspect in the Mahabharata that you do have events that constrain the narrative, which is what you're claiming. But it's the degree to which the constraint is operative, and the degree to which you're going away from that or you care about it. I'm not sure if I've got a question there of just...
Many used to say that history is one of the few things we can change.
We can change history.
Completely throws in the air what many people's idea of what history is.
Yeah.
Mm.
I'd say that there's no such thing as a true story.
Mm.
No.
There just cannot be any such thing.
Mm.
A story is a story, and the truth is ineffable.
So in a sense, is it the event that is important, or the meaning of an event? And so in that sense, all this mythology is like a condensed stories about events and the meanings all together, right?
Yeah.
With no clear distinction where does event stops and the meaning begins. Interpretation, right? Of it as a condensed lessons from history.
Yeah.
In a sense, yeah.
But I mean, you have to, I mean, like the Rama's army didn't fly to Sri Lanka on a on a Vahana.
Yeah, yeah.
Did they?
Vimana.
Vimana. Presumably.
The Jains say he did.
But we know, do we? We know better, don't we?
Do we?
Who knows?
Well, the Jains are closer to the historical reality, the event we are culturally in terms of when this was first unpacked times. I'm just being devil's advocate, you know. Why do we think that we know better?
Because, well, we know that magic doesn't work.
but then we know that that in many ways the viewing these texts as historiography just doesn't work then.
So you can
say maybe there was a big war and the Mahabharata portrays it, but all kinds of things happen in the Mahabharata which don't happen in this world.
No, that's right.
People being born from pots.
Mm.
It's just, you know, it doesn't happen.
So you'd have to say the kind of truth that it's talking about is about meaning rather than about events. Yeah.
But to go back to what you were saying, I wouldn't like to contrast myself with any traditional reception community.
Oh, okay.
Because I think this traditional reception community was invented very recently, and I think that I am as much who the Mahabharata was intended for as anybody else
okay.
on the planet.
Mm.
You know, I don't. It's not for owning. It's for everybody. It explicitly says it's for everybody.
Mm.
So
some people don't have privilege ownership of it.
No, they don't. Even if the fact that it has survived this long is not due to my direct ancestors so much as to some other people's.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't give you a privileged interpretive position.
Does science give us a privileged interpretive position?
What do you mean by science?
Philology.
Philology is scientific, is it?
I don't think so, but I mean, some people think so. I think it's an art, as you say. It's interesting, isn't it? It's a very deep and interesting question.
Well, it depends who the us is, because in theory the benefits of science are available to all. I mean, if we think of the philological science that went into the making of the critical editions of the Mahabharata Ramayana, those texts are now just on the web.
Mm.
Anyone can get them.
Mm.
And there is really no us there.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't want to. Yeah. This is very. I mean, we're going to have to stop him a bit. But yeah, Paul Ricoeur says, I mean, all texts are equal to me as the reader, whether it's 100 years old or written yesterday. You know, I'm in sympathy with that, as I think you are
from
the presentation. You know. It's one. Any last points?
I have a quick one.
Okay.
Regarding the so-called, you know, Sanskrit epic, I wondered the so-called.
Oh yeah.
Yes. I didn't go into that at all in this version.
Just
in general, I'm wary of the term epic because I think it encodes the prejudice that certain bits of the text are old and certain bits are young, which I just don't believe at all anymore.
I agree.
You know, Hopkins uses the word pseudo-epic for whichever bits of the Mahabharata he doesn't like and therefore deems to be late Brahmanical interpolations. So this term epic is it's a kind of obsolete term based on some kind of Aryan myth, I think.
So how do you call it?
I call them the Mahabharata and the Ramayana.
No category.
So you wouldn't want to put them in a genre?
Yeah.
Not really, no.
Just stories.
No. I mean,
history.
They obviously have quite a lot in common. But, I mean, traditionally they have so many genre labels. And one might say that the main genre label for the Mahabharata is Itihasa, and the main genre label for the Ramayana is Kavya or Adikavya.
Mm.
If so, then they're in different genres.
Okay.
Which, so, I don't. Yeah.
You're happy with that?
Yeah, I just stick to the titles.
Mm. Okay. Well, thank you, Simon, for an extremely interesting and thought-provoking paper, and which is. Given rise to a lot of thought on my part and a lot of good discussion. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your response.